Sheriff Ken Katsaris. I received a phone call from Ted on September 26, 1978. A collect call, but one which I accepted readily. I had heard nothing from him and had been following events in Florida only through the media since July. The connection was blurred. I was not sure that we were alone on the line. He explained that a new order had come down, an order that allowed him to have outdoor exercise. For the first time in 7 months, they took me outside for something other than going back and forth to hearings. Two armed guards with walkie-talkies took me up on the roof and let me walk in circles. Down below, they had three patrol cars and three attack dogs. I suggested that even he couldn't leap four stories. "Who do they think I am?" he laughed. "The bionic man?" He described his cell. "There's no natural light. It's an iron cell in the midst of other walls. There's one 150-watt recessed bulb in the ceiling with a plastic shield and a metal grating. By the time it filters down to me, there's hardly any light. It's 1/60th of what it should be for humane purposes. I've got a bed, a combination sink and toilet, and a portable radio that gets two stations. It felt so good today to be out in the air without shackles, even to listen to the dogs bark. I haven't heard a dog bark in a long time." Ted was adamant that they would never break him. "All the psychological evaluations they've done here. In the last one, they told the sheriff that if he read the indictment to me the way he did, that it would break me and I'd talk. Immediately after they took me back to my cell, two detectives came in and said, 'Now you see how much we got on you? There's no place else to go. You might just as well make it easy on yourself and talk.' But they didn't break me then." For the first time, Ted mentioned Carol Ann Boone to me, saying that he had become very, very close to her, and that he was listening to her advice on how to handle matters of interest to him. He talked of his chagrin at losing Millard Farmer. "The man's about 37, looks 50, and he handles about 20 capital cases a year. He runs himself into the ground. But now I'm prepared to defend myself in both cases." He was angry that he was being paraded both in Tallahassee and Lake City, where he went 3 times a week for hearings on the Leach case. And yet, there was an undercurrent of pride that he was in the public eye again, and would be for a long time to come. "The Chi Omega case is very bizarre. I'm not going to go into it. But the combination of Ted Bundy and a case like that, I'll be in the limelight for a long time. The evidence has all been fabricated. The people here are absolutely determined to get convictions, even if they know they'll be overturned later. All they care about is shackling me and getting me up in front of a jury, and back-to-back trials to boot." He said he was talking from the booking room in the jail, but he apparently had made his feelings about Florida lawmen vocal enough already so that he had no qualms about annoying them further. It was September 26th, Ted's anniversary with Meg. A year before, he'd asked me to send the rose. Now he said that Meg had finally left him. "I guess she talked to some reporters. I don't know. I haven't heard from her in a long time. She told me she just couldn't take this anymore, that she didn't want to hear any more about it. How long since you've seen her?" "A long time," I told him. It had been more than a year. I'm sure he realized what day it was. Perhaps that was why he had called me, to talk about Meg. He had Carol Ann Boone now, but he hadn't forgotten Meg. I asked him what time it was in Florida, and he hesitated.
"I don't know. Time doesn't mean anything anymore."
Ted's voice drifted away, and I thought the line had been broken. "Ted? Ted?" He came back on, and he sounded vague, disoriented. He apologized.
"Sometimes in the middle of a conversation, I forget what I've said before. I have trouble remembering."
It was the first time I had ever heard him so unsure, almost slipping away from what was here and now. But then his voice became strong again. He was anxious for trial, anxious to face the challenge. "Your voice sounds good," I remarked. "You sound like yourself." His answer was a little strange.
"I usually am."
Ted had only one request. He asked me to send him the classified section of the Seattle Sunday Times. He didn't say why he wanted it. Nostalgia, perhaps. Maybe reading the ads in his hometown paper would help to wipe out the sight of the iron walls with no windows. I sent him the paper. I don't know if he got it.
I wouldn't talk to him or hear from him again until just before his Miami trial in June 1979. Chapter 41. It is extremely doubtful that Ted Bundy could ever have received an impartial trial in the state of Florida. He was becoming better known than Disney World, the Everglades, and the heretofore all-time media pleaser, Murph the Surf. Paradoxically, Ted himself both courted and demeaned publicity. His very attitude made him ripe for headlines. On October 29, 1978, Dr. Richard Suveron, a forensic odontologist, an expert in matching teeth impressions to bite marks in dental identification, put on a demonstration at a forensic seminar that seemed premature at best. Suveron from Coral Gables presented slides, slides he said proved that this suspect's teeth matched the bite marks on the victim's buttock. Naturally, this information was disseminated throughout the state's media, and everyone knew that Ted Bundy was the suspect referred to. Predictably, Ted screamed foul. Dr. Ronald Wright, chief deputy medical examiner for Dade County, equivocated when he tried to explain how such a gaffe could happen.
You have to balance the kinds of problems which might exist in regards to talking about a case in litigation against teaching the best possible method for correctly identifying murderers or clearing people of murder charges, he remarked.
The obvious question, of course, was why this could not have been done without hinting broadly at the identity of the principals involved. Beyond that, there were other cases which could have been offered as examples where identification had been made through teeth imprints. A Brattleboro, Vermont man had been convicted in 1976 of the rape murder of 62-year-old Ruth Kastenbaum, convicted because the 25 bite marks on her body matched his teeth. Suveron himself had another case where he had made bite mark matches. He had matched the teeth of a 23-year-old man from Columbia, South Carolina, to the body of 77-year-old Margaret Hazlip, who lived in a rural area south of Miami. But Ted was more newsworthy than an itinerant laborer from South Carolina, and Ted's teeth got the publicity. The publication of Suveron's findings seemed to go far beyond normal pretrial publicity. It seemed for a time that charges against Ted for murder might well be dismissed because of Suveron's statements. They were not, however, and the state moved ahead, preparing for the two trials. Pre-trial publicity is a two-edged sword. It can prejudice an innocent man so that he cannot obtain a fair trial, and it can occasionally result in a guilty man's going free when charges are dismissed. In either instance, such publicity can be tragic. Two of Ted Bundy's most hated antagonists had dropped completely from the picture by late 1978. One through personal disgrace, and the other when his health collapsed. I don't know if Ted knew about either of them, or if it would matter to him any longer. Frank Tucker, the district attorney from Pitkin County, Colorado, was convicted, June 1978, of two counts of embezzlement and acquitted of two counts. In December 1978, he was convicted of one count of felony theft and two misdemeanor counts. Tucker cried, as Ted had about his own case, that the charges and convictions were all politically motivated. He was disbarred, received 5 years probation, 90 days in jail, to be delayed, and a $1,000 fine. According to his attorney, Tucker planned to pursue a new career. He would go to mortician school in San Francisco. Now Major Nick Mackey of the King County Police Major Crimes Unit in Seattle suffered a near-fatal heart attack in the spring of 1978, and paramedics had pronounced him clinically dead twice. Mackey survived, but was forced to resign from the high-pressure job he'd handled so well for so long. The loss of Mackey would be a blow for the department. Ted himself wasn't doing so well. As the Christmas season approached in 1978, he was again in jail, looking at a solid steel door, just as he had been a year before. But this year, there were no plans to escape. There was no way to escape. Again, he was faced with a murder trial, just as he had been in December 1977. Indeed, he was faced with two murder trials. Bundy had moved to have Judge John Rudd removed because of prejudice, and shortly before Christmas, the Florida State Supreme Court acquiesced. There had been claims by the defense that Rudd had improperly communicated with the state attorney's office and that he had evinced hostility toward the defense team. Rudd stepped down. A new judge would be appointed in the coming year.
Larry Simpson, an assistant state's attorney, would be chief prosecutor in the Chi Omega case and announced that he was ready to go to trial at any time. But a trial before February seemed unlikely. Ted had grudgingly accepted the aid of the public defender's office, and his defense team was headed by Mike Minerva. Ted apparently was aware, finally, that he would be a fool to attempt to defend himself in two murder trials. In January, a new judge was appointed, Judge Edward D. Cowart of the Florida Circuit Court. Judge Cowart, 54, is a great St. Bernard of a man, jowls bulging over his judicial robes with a southern, soothing voice. Cowart has been a Navy bosun's mate and a policeman before graduating from Stetson University Law School in St. Petersburg. His home court is in Miami, and he controls his courtroom with authority, authority that is often laced with sharp wit and homilies. He is given to saying, "Bless your heart," to attorneys and defendants alike. When an argument is not clear, he will say, "Cripple that and walk it by me slow." He is a man both benign and belligerent, depending on the circumstance, and he knows his law inside out. In court, Cowart often seems to be giving instruction in law to the attorneys who appear before him. Ted wasn't going to like him much. On February 22nd, Cowart announced that Ted would go on trial for the Chi Omega murders and the Tallahassee attacks on May 21st. He also again denied Bundy's request for Millard Farmer. The judge said he would decide in April if a non-prejudiced jury could be impaneled in the capital city. He agreed with the defense that it was unlikely that back-to-back trials could be held without prejudicing the defendant. Ted was still officially the lead defense attorney. Minerva was only there to advise him as far as he was concerned. The defendant requested on April 11th that news people be barred from taking his picture when he was brought to the courthouse in chains and wearing his leg brace, and from attending the proceedings leading up to trial. He would be questioning witnesses himself, he said, and he didn't want the media listening in. Judge Cowart denied that request, saying, "If you exclude the press, you exclude the public." A month later, Ted had had enough of Judge Cowart and moved to have him step down just as Judge Rudd had, claiming that Rudd's prejudice had flowed to Cowart, too. Cowart denied the motion, saying it was legally insufficient. Anyone who has observed Judge Cowart over time would doubt that he could ever be swayed or prejudiced by others' opinions. He is a man who patently thinks for himself. The Bundy hearings were now being recorded by a television camera and by one still camera, as had been agreed in a recent Florida Supreme Court edict. Cowart continued to deny Ted's request for the barring of all cameras.
"We're conducting the public's business, gentlemen, and we're going to conduct it in the sunshine. We're sitting in Florida."
Cowart would rarely display any animosity toward the defendant who railed against him, although as the months progressed, he would at times chastise Bundy's temper tantrums as he would a small child. He seemed to bear no particular ill will toward Ted. Even as Ted had asked to have him removed from the case, Cowart remarked on Ted's suit and tie,
"You look nice today."
And Ted had responded, "I'm disguised as an attorney today." The pretrial hearings began in May in Tallahassee. The defense wanted the bite mark testimony out, claiming that there had been insufficient probable cause for the search warrant that brought Ted to a dentist to have his teeth impressions taken. The defense claimed that he had not been a true suspect in the Chi Omega killings at that time. Cowart delayed his ruling. Ted Bundy's murder trial was to begin on June 11th, but on the last day of May, there were rampant rumors that he was going to change his plea, that he would plea bargain to a lesser charge than first-degree murder and thus save himself from the specter of the electric chair. Florida's electric chair was a terribly real threat. Only 5 days before, Florida had proved that it would carry out its death sentences. On May 25th, John Spenkelink, convicted of the murder in 1973 of killing a fellow ex-con in a Tallahassee motel room, had been executed. It was the first execution in the United States since Gary Gilmore had gone before the firing squad in Utah on January 19, 1977, at his own request. It was the first where a condemned man had gone into the death chamber against his will in America since 1967. Ted Bundy had been geographically close to both men, fully aware of the fate of both,
and he must have realized that Spenkelink's fate might await him in the not-too-distant future. Louise Bundy flew to Tallahassee, as did John Henry Brown. Carol Ann Boone joined his mother and Brown in urging him to plead guilty to lesser charges. There had been a great deal of negotiating back and forth between Tallahassee, Leon County, Lake City, the prosecution, and the defense. It was rumored that if Ted would plead guilty to second-degree murder in the two Chi Omega cases and in Kimberly Leach's murder, he would avoid the chair. The state would agree that he serve instead 3 consecutive 25-year terms. On May 31st, there was a private session in Judge Cowart's chambers with Ted and his attorneys present. Ted filed a secret motion, a motion believed to be the guilty pleas to second-degree murder. It would mean that he might never walk free again, but he wouldn't die in the electric chair either. According to Florida Deputy State Attorney Jerry Blair, who awaited his day in the courtroom with Ted in the Leach case, Ted acknowledged his guilt to everything he was charged with in both cases. Blair alleged that Ted, in fact, carried in his hand a written confession. All of his legal advisors, including Millard Farmer and Mike Minerva, had urged him to accept the lifeline held out. But the plea bargaining broke down. Ted tore up the papers in his hand and told Cowart, "I'd like to withdraw that motion." Ted moved to have his public defender, Minerva, removed from the case, claiming that Minerva was trying to coerce him into admitting guilt. The state attorneys could not enter into a plea bargain in such a case. With Ted intimating that his own attorney was pressuring him to confess, any plea bargaining would automatically be overturned by an appellate court. Blair vowed that if he, Ted, wanted a trial, he was going to get it. None of the specifics of Ted's almost guilty plea reached the press, but rumors were strong, and it had been Ted's last chance. Governor Bob Graham had predicted he would sign more death warrants, and Ted's name seemed already to be written there in invisible ink. Minerva wanted out. Ted wanted him out, calling his public defender incompetent. It looked like any trial would be postponed once again. Ted himself wanted a 90-day delay, and the defense team wanted a psychiatric exam to see if he was sane in the legal sense, that is, that he had sufficient mental and psychological competence to participate in his own defense. This latter request angered him as much as anything had angered him before. Ted may have joked in his letter to me about an insanity defense, but he would not go that route seriously now that he was up and confident again. Judge Cowart was not about to stand for endless trial delays. He agreed to the psychiatric examinations and ordered that they be done forthwith. He had 132 prospective jurors on hold. It had already been 18 months since a stranger crept into the Chi Omega mansion, since a man had beaten Cheryl Thomas at Dunwoody Street, and Cowart felt it was time for the trial to begin. 2 psychiatrists examined Ted during that first week of June 1979. Dr. Herve Cleckley of Augusta, Georgia, and Dr. Emmanuel Tanay, a professor at Wayne State University in Michigan. They agreed with Ted that he was not incompetent, but said he demonstrated certain antisocial behavior. Tanay said that Ted's personality disorder was such that it could affect his relationship with his attorneys, and thus, in that way, hinder his ability to defend himself. "He has an extensive history of self-defeating, unadaptable, antisocial behavior," Tanay said. On June 11th, Judge Cowart ruled that Ted Bundy was competent to stand trial and said that he would delay his decision on granting a change of venue until he had seen some responses from prospective veniri men in the Leon County area. He denied the defense request for an extension and refused to let Ted fire his attorneys. Temporarily, Bundy had a new attorney, Brian T. Hayes, a respected North Florida criminal defense attorney, but also a man who came with unsettling references at the time. He had been John Spenkelink's attorney. I had written to Ted to tell him that I would be attending his trial, to see if I would be able to visit him, and to warn him that I would probably be wearing a press badge. It was the only way I could be sure of getting into the courtroom. The gallery would be jammed, and there would be long lines of curious courtgoers. With Ted's growing hatred for reporters, I didn't want him to see me among a sea of media people and think I had defected completely to the Fourth Estate. I had reservations to Tallahassee, but I would never see that city.
Judge Cowart granted a change of venue on June 12th, when four of the first five prospective jurors said they knew so much about the Chi Omega murders that they could not sit on the jury and be considered unbiased. Cowart ordered the trial moved to Miami and said jury selection would begin there on June 25th. Mike Minerva would not be joining the defense team. Relations between himself and Bundy had become so abrasive that they probably could not hide their antagonism from a jury. Minerva also felt that he might bear Ted some unconscious resentment, since Ted had cast so much doubt about his ability. The defense team would be Leon County Assistant Public Defenders Lynn Thompson, Ed Harvey, and Margaret Good. They were all young, all determined to do their best, and all woefully inexperienced. A Miami attorney, Robert Haggard, not much older than the rest of the team, volunteered to help. In my opinion, Haggard was the least apt of any of the team members. He seemed ill-prepared, and his manner, even his haircut, appeared to grate on Judge Cowart's nerves. Peggy Good may have been the most effective of all Bundy's latest team of attorneys. Ms. Good, in her late 20s, impressed the jury simply because she was a woman standing beside a man accused of brutal attacks on other women. Slender, blonde, bespectacled, she chose loose, almost baggy clothing that did nothing for her basic attractiveness. Her voice would remain flat and serious. Only when she was tired would she slip into the drawl of a true down-home Southern girl. Cowart liked her, and she would receive many of his bless-your-hearts. Ted was pleased with her, too. He was enthusiastic in his phone call to me on the evening of June 28th, a call placed from the Dade County Jail in Miami. Ted sounded confident again and exhilarated. He admitted that he was exhausted, however.
They flew me down here in a single-engine plane, rushed me into jail, and we began jury selection the next morning. I lost a little of my momentum. Cowart's hurrying us through. We work till 10:30 every other night, and we're going to have Saturday sessions.
Breakfast in the Dade County Jail was, and God knows why, at 4:30 a.m., and Ted was tired, but elated over his defense team and his budget.
The sky's the limit. The state has given us $100,000 for our defense. I'm glad I don't have Mike Minerva anymore. I like my defense team, especially the fact that I have a woman on my side. I have an expert on jury selection who's helping me pick the jury. He can tell by their eyes, their facial expressions, their body language, what they're thinking. For instance, one prospective juror today raised his hand to his heart, and that means something to my expert.
Even in Miami, however, most of those in the jury pool had heard of Ted Bundy. One juror selected, Estela Suarez, had never heard of him.
She only reads Spanish language papers, Ted said enthusiastically. She kept smiling at me. She didn't realize I was a defendant.
There was one young woman Ted had felt ill at ease about, a girl he described as a perfect candidate for a sorority, a nice, fresh-faced, rosy-cheeked, pretty young girl. I was afraid she'd identify with the victims. Ted extolled Carol Ann Boone's loyalty.
She's thrown in her lot with me, moved down here, given up her job. She has all my files, and I've given her my permission to talk to the news media. In order for her to survive, I told her to ask for $100 a day and board and room in payment for interviews.
Ted was eager to see me when I got to Miami. He suggested that I contact Sergeant Marty Kratz, the jailer on his floor, to arrange for a visit.
He's a pretty good guy.
He seemed to understand that I would have to be in the courtroom sitting in the press section, and he assured me he would do everything he could to see I got into the trial.
If you have any trouble, you come to me. I'm the golden boy. I'll see that you get in.
He was confident that we would be able to talk, too, during court recesses and before evening sessions. He was insistent that I try to get in to see him in jail as soon as I got to Miami. I fully expected that I would get to see him, but things would not work out that way. Ted felt that he was going to have a fair trial. He even spoke well of Judge Cowart and said,
I'll never have an appeal based on the inadequacy of my defense team because they're good.
Are you able to sleep? I asked.
I sleep like a baby.
The only matter that was really rankling Ted at this point was Dr. Tanay's testimony.
I only agreed to talk to him because it was my understanding the session was to be tape recorded for the benefit of the defense. Spenkelink's lawyer, Brian Hayes, told me to do that.
I was appalled and shocked when Tanne got up in open court and said I was dangerous to myself and others, a sociopath, an antisocial personality, that I shouldn't be allowed to go free. That was when I realized, and only then, that the court had ordered the examination, not the defense.
Are you still not smoking? I asked.
I wasn't, but I bought a pack just before that flight down here at night in that single-engine plane. I just finished it, and it's been several days, so that's not so bad.
He commented that the vast majority of the jurors picked at that point were black or blue-collar workers, and that seemed good. I asked him if he didn't feel that the very intelligent potential juror, someone who might weigh all sides of a question, might not also be the assiduous newspaper reader.
No, that doesn't necessarily follow. A lot of the professionals are so caught up in their careers that they don't read anything but professional journals. Many of them don't seem to have heard about me.
Are you at all afraid for your personal safety?
Not at all. I'm too well known, a cause celeb. They won't let anything happen to me. They want to get me into court safely.
He sounded completely in control. There was none of the vagueness, the slipping away that I'd noticed in his phone call of 9 months earlier. He explained how the trial would run, the pretrial period where all the 150 witnesses would give brief testimony to see if it could be allowed into trial itself or would be suppressed. He explained the trial phase and the penalty phase and said that the prosecution was allowing jurors to be seated who were against the death penalty. Ted was clearly a captain in charge of his own ship.
What's on television in Seattle? He asked. Are they covering me very much back there?
Quite a bit. I watched you in Tallahassee when you introduced yourself to the prospective jurors there. You seemed very confident. He was pleased. I have no way of knowing if Ted truly felt the confidence which he projected, but going into his Miami trial, he seemed to believe that he could and would win. After an hour's conversation which he told me was being monitored by Dade County jailers, we hung up, promising to meet again, this time in Miami. To newspaper men, Ted declined to predict the trial outcome.
If I was a football coach, I'd say when you're in your first game of the season, you don't start looking for the Super Bowl.
Dr. Emil Spillman, the Atlanta hypnotist who had been Ted's jury expert, told the press that Ted truly had chosen his own jury. They had had to go through 77 potential jurors before they reached a final selection on June 30th. Spillman felt that Ted had passed over 17 or 18 choices whom he, Spillman, termed
emotionally perfect, but I told him, it's your life, not mine.
Spillman shrugged.
He passed up some absolutely fantastic jurors.
The final 12 were largely middle-aged, largely black. Ted and Ted alone had chosen. It was his life. The jurors were Alan Smith, the clothing designer, who leaned away from the death penalty. Estella Suarez, a bookkeeper. It was Ms. Suarez who had sparked laughter in the courtroom during jury selection when she failed to recognize Ted as a defendant. Vernon Swindle, a worker in the mailroom of the Miami Herald, who said he didn't have time to read the papers he helped to put out. Rudolph Tremmel, a senior project engineer for Texaco, highly educated, a man with a scientifically oriented mind who would become the jury foreman, a man who said he only read technical journals. Bernice Donald, a high school teacher, a deacon in his church. Floy Mitchell, a housewife, devout, who watched soap operas more than she read the daily headlines. Ruth Hamilton, a maid, a churchgoer too. Her nephew was a Tallahassee policeman. Robert Corbett, a sports enthusiast who rarely read the paper beyond the sports page. He knew Ted was accused of murdering somebody. Maisie Edge, just retired as an elementary school principal. Her bout with the flu would soon delay the trial. Dave Brown, a maintenance engineer for a Miami hotel. Mary Russo, a supermarket clerk who seemed in awe of her call to jury duty and who did not favor the death penalty. James Bennett, a truck driver, father of five, who had never considered Ted's guilt one way or another. These then, along with three alternates, would be the jury of Ted Bundy's peers, the citizens of Dade County, Florida, who would decide whether the young man from Tacoma, Washington would live or die. Chapter 42. I flew out of SeaTac Airport in Seattle, headed for Miami at 1 in the morning on July 3rd.
I had been promised press credentials when I arrived at my destination, the Dade County Metro Justice Center. I understood there were 300 reporters already there, ready to digest and disseminate every scrap of information on Ted Bundy via phone and wire to the rest of America. Once again, I felt the sense of unreality of it all, more so when I found the in-flight movie was Love at First Bite. The rest of the passengers flying thousands of feet above a sleeping country laughed aloud at the high camp of George Hamilton's Dracula as he plunged his teeth into beautiful maidens. Under the circumstances, I found no humor in it. It would be 42 hours before I slept again. We crossed the Great Divide. To the left of the plane, I could see dawn beginning to break, but it was still pitch black to my right. Soon I could see the historic rivers down below as they snaked their way to the sea, cities slumbering in the distance. We landed in Atlanta at 6 a.m., waited an hour or so, and then flew south in a smaller plane. The vast isolation of the Everglades seemed endless, and then there was Miami ahead. So flat, so spread out, it was the very antithesis of Seattle, which is built on a succession of hills. The July heat of southern Florida rose up and seemed to knock me backward as I emerged from the Miami airport. During the weeks I spent in Miami, I would never adjust to that palpable heat. It was constant. Even the sudden late afternoon thunderstorms wept only great drops of hot water and left the air as oppressive as it had been before. Nor did evening bring respite, as it always did in the Northwest. The sight of palm trees assailed me with an attack of homesickness, reminded me of those long months in Los Angeles, and reminded me also that Ted could probably never go home again. I dumped my bags in my motel and took a cab to the Dade County Metro Justice Center, a lush new complex which lies in the shadow of the Orange Bowl. As I entered the reception area of the Dade County Public Safety Department substation which housed the jail, connected by a sky bridge to the Metro Justice Building where Ted's trial was being held on the fourth floor, I was immediately aware of the intense security. No one was even allowed on the elevators to the upper floors without first being cleared and handed a badge. I had to have that clearance badge before I could go upstairs to the public relations office and get another clearance badge that would allow me into the trial. They were taking no chances of escape for Ted in Miami. Henceforth, I would be News Media Number 15. I went first to the ninth floor of the Metro Justice Building and found that the entire top floor of the huge building had been given over to the press. I have never seen anything like it. The activity there was frantic. 36 closed-circuit television sets blaring out every word of the trial 5 floors below. Anchormen, anchorwomen, technicians, reporters, scores of them, watching, broadcasting, editing, splicing. The cacophony seemed to bother no one. The rooms were thick with cigarette smoke, littered with coffee cups. The indoor-outdoor carpet was a squirming network of wires and cables. Cables from a single TV camera in the courtroom had been strung from the fourth floor courtroom, secured to the building exterior, and fed into this central control room. There, a series of distribution amplifiers split the signal so that what was happening could be fed to all three networks at once. The segments chosen by the networks were relayed to the eighth floor, where Southern Bell had installed a microwave dish to transmit the signals to downtown Miami for wire transmission to a special Florida TV system. The same signals went by wire to Atlanta, where ABC transmitted them to New York via Telstar 1 satellite and by Telstar 2 to California and the West Coast. CBS had provided the single courtroom camera, and it was being manned alternately by cameramen from all the networks. Ted had told me he was the golden boy, and for the media, he certainly appeared to be just that. I looked around the room. Stations from Colorado, Utah, Washington, and Florida had tacked up handwritten signs as they established their territory. The ninth floor of the Metro Justice Building would run around the clock throughout the trial. I, who have always bemoaned the loneliness of writing, trapped all alone in my basement office at home, wouldn't be lonely here. I was amazed at the discipline of my fellow reporters who seemed able to turn out finished copy in this boiler room of noise and scurrying activity.
I stashed my tape recorder upstairs. It would not be allowed in the courtroom. Later, I learned the trick of turning it on next to the closed-circuit TV set in the back room and then racing down to the trial. That way, I would have both my notes from the live action and the complete trial on tape. I exited the elevators on the fourth floor and headed toward the courtroom. Quite frankly, I was terrified, venturing into totally uncharted territory, about to view the culmination of 4 years of ambivalence and worry. If Judge Edward Cowart is a St. Bernard, then his bailiff, Dave Watson, is a feisty bulldog, protective and fiercely so of Cowart. We would all come to fear and respect Watson's authority as he bellowed,
"Please be seated. Court will come to order."
And,
"Stay seated till the judge is out of the courtroom."
And woe be unto anyone who might have to visit the restroom during sessions. Watson would permit no aimless coming and going. But now, bless him, he approached me as I stood tentatively outside the courtroom. In his 70s, white-haired, he was wearing his uniform of sparkling white shirt, dark trousers. I didn't know enough to realize this was the dread Bailiff Watson, and he smiled, put both his arms around me, and said,
"You go right on in, honey."
Cowart's courtroom is a vast octagonal room, the walls paneled with tropical wood and brass rectangles behind the bench of marble. Fake? Possibly. Light fixtures of white, aqua, red, and wine were suspended from the ceiling. The 33 press seats were to the left as one entered. Opposite them were seats reserved for law enforcement officers. Beyond that were 100 or more seats for the gallery. No windows, but it was air-conditioned. I have always found a trial something of a temporary microcosm of life. The judge is the father, kindly, authoritative, guiding us all, and Edward Cowart would fill that role well. The rest of us, jury, defense, prosecution, gallery, press, were to be thrown together in an intense communal experience. When it ends, it is somehow sad. We will never be this close again. Most of us will never meet again. This trial would be, for me, akin to having all the characters in a long, long book finally come alive. I knew the names of almost everyone involved, had heard of them for years, though Ted was the only character I had actually seen in person before. I took a seat in the press section among strangers who would become friends. Jean Miller, 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner from the Miami Herald. Tony Polk from the Rocky Mountain News in Denver. Linda Kleindienst and George McAvoy of the Fort Lauderdale News and Sun Sentinel. George Thurston of the Washington Post. Pat McMahon of the St. Petersburg Times, Rick Barry of the Tampa Tribune, Bill Knowles, Southern Bureau Chief of ABC News, all scribbling notes in their own particular fashion. Ted glanced over, recognized me, grinned, winked. He looked barely older than the last time I had seen him, but was perfectly attired in suit and tie, styled haircut. It was odd somehow, as if time had stood still for him. Dorian Gray flashed through my mind. I was a grandmother now, twice over, and yet Ted was still the same outwardly as he had been in 1971, perhaps handsomer. I looked around the courtroom. I saw faces that I have seen in dozens of trials, those whose whole life revolves around going to court. It is their only hobby, interest, avocation. Neatly dressed old men. An old woman with garish makeup, her hair hidden by a wrapped stocking, a huge picture hat on top of it all. Housewives playing hooky. A priest. Stolid rows of lawmen in uniform. The front row, just behind Ted and the defense team, was jammed with pretty young women, as it would be each day. Did they know how much they resembled the defendant's purported victims? Their eyes never left Ted, and they blushed and giggled with delight when he turned to flash a blinding smile at them, as he often did. Outside the courtroom, some of them would admit to reporters that Ted frightened them, yet they couldn't stay away. It is a common syndrome, this fascination that an alleged mass killer has for some women, as if he was the ultimate macho figure. By tacit agreement, that one front row was somehow reserved for the Ted groupies. And indeed, I would never see a trial with more attractive women present. The Chi Omegas, testifying about the night of January 14th, 15th, 1978. The surviving victims,
even the female detectives, deputies, and the court reporters. The jury was not present those first days. We were still in pretrial, and Cowart had yet to rule on what the court would allow in. The jury remained sequestered in a plush resort on Bay Biscayne. An uninformed observer would have difficulty distinguishing Ted from any of the young lawyers in the courtroom, Lynn Thompson, Ed Harvey, Bob Haggard, and for the prosecution, Larry Simpson and Danny McKeever, both from the state attorney's office. The defense wanted many of the state's proposed witnesses out. Connie Hastings and Marianne Picano, the girls who had seen the man in Sherrod's disco earlier on that Saturday night. Nita Neary, the CIO who had seen the man with the club. Dr. Suvaron with his bite mark testimony. Sergeant Bob Hayward on the Utah arrest. Carol Durant from Salt Lake City. Detective Norm Chapman and Don Patchen in their testimony about the conversations during the interrogation in mid-February in Pensacola. Nita Jane Neary was on the witness stand as I entered the courtroom. She had been badgered by the defense and was almost tearful, but resolute. Asked if she saw the man in the courtroom that she'd seen that night, she said, "Yes, I believe I do," but she wanted a profile look. Cowart ordered every man in the room to stand and turn sideways. Nita Jane looked, but seemed reluctant to look directly at Ted. Then she raised her arm, somewhat mechanically, and still with eyes downcast, she pointed at the defendant. Ted helped the court reporter by saying about himself, "That's Mr. Bundy." The defense questioned Nita and her mother. Yes, her mother had shown her newspaper pictures of Ted Bundy taken after his arrest, but she had also picked him out of a mug laydown later. She was positive. Judge Cowart would subsequently rule to allow her eyewitness identification, possibly the worst blow that would be dealt the defense. Ronnie Eng, the sweetheart of Chi Omega, the man Nita Neary had first thought she recognized, had been cleared by a polygraph, but he too appeared in pretrial. As he stood beside Bundy, there was little resemblance. Ronnie was dark-complexioned, shorter, with black hair. He made a shy, smiling witness. Carol Ann Boone, Ted's staunchest ally, sat in the courtroom, her eyes meeting his often. A tall, big-boned woman of about 32, she wore thick glasses, had short, dark hair, not parted in the middle. She seldom smiled and usually carried sheaves of reports. Her connection to the defendant seemed to be her only interest. When court ended that first day, I approached Carol Boone and introduced myself. She glanced at me and said, "Yes, I've heard of you," and turned abruptly on her heel and walked away. Somewhat bemused, I stared after her. Did she dislike me so because I was wearing a press badge, or because I was an old friend of Ted's? I never found out. She never spoke to me again. The next court session began with requests by Ted for more exercise, law library privileges, a typewriter. Both the library and the exercise facilities were on the 7th floor of the jail building. Ted and his jail supervisor engaged in a little repartee.
"Can you have enough security for me?"
"We better have."
"How many? One, two, three?"
"We don't care to be specific. We'll have enough."
Cowart asked,
"Can you read while you exercise, Mr. Bundy?"
Ted, wearing on this day a Seattle Mariners t-shirt, laughed faintly. He wanted an hour a day in the law library, an hour's exercise a day, unlimited visits with Carol Ann Boone, who is
relaying my messages to me for my lawyers out west.
And Cowart does not concur, nor will there be a typewriter. A new figure appears, another name from the book in my mind. Sergeant Bob Hayward of the Utah Highway Patrol in Miami to describe Ted's arrest in August of 1975. When Hayward refers to a pantyhose mask, Judge Cowart objects for Attorney Bundy, saying,
"You miss that, my friend, but we'll catch him together."
And now began one of the most bizarre sequences I have ever seen in a courtroom. Ted Bundy would be at the same time the defendant, the defense attorney, and then the witness. Ted rose to cross-examine Hayward. He questioned the witness closely about the Utah arrest, the gear in his car, what was said, and tried to point out that he had never given permission to have his VW bug searched. Hayward, a bit put off by being questioned by the defendant, answered gruffly,
"You told me to go ahead."
And then Ted questioned Deputy Darrell Ondrak of the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office,
arguing about whether the items found in his car were burglary tools, pointing out that though he was charged on that count, he was never tried on that count. Cowart intervened.
You can argue that to the hills of Utah, if they were burglary tools. It's not relevant here. Quit when you're ahead. But I didn't say how far ahead.
Ted himself now became the witness and took the stand. He testified that Hayward's first words to him were, "Why didn't you get out of your car and run? I could have taken your head off." He explained that he had been intimidated by the number of officers present and that the search was illegal in his estimation. He opened himself up to cross-examination by Danny McKeever and the admission that he had lied about going to the drive-in before being stopped. Ted wanted the Utah arrest suppressed, insisting its evidence was seized through an illegal search. Judge Cowart would suppress it, but not for that reason. He found that arrest too remote from this trial.
You may step down, Mr. Bundy, but you may not be excused.
These transactions would result in a blow against the prosecution. They would not be able to compare the Utah pantyhose mask with the Dunwoody Street pantyhose mask in front of the jury. The score now stood 1-1. Judge Cowart would rarely betray his own feelings during the trial, but he slipped a little as he glanced at a composite picture drawn by an artist from Nita Neary's description, a picture Peggy Good argued was meaningless.
"I may be blind," Cowart began, "but looking at that last picture, I see a striking resemblance to, whoever it was."
After hearing the tapes taken in Pensacola and the testimony offered by Detectives Norm Chapman and Don Patchen of statements alleged to have been made by Ted after the tape recorder was turned off, Judge Cowart made another ruling to suppress, a ruling that caused prosecutors Simpson and McKeever to sag in their chairs. The jury would not be allowed to hear or know of any of it. Nothing of the escape, the credit card thefts, the statements about vampirism, voyeurism, fantasies. Cowart found that too much of the alleged conversations were missing, unrecorded. He would not allow the portions that were on tape. The credit card thefts were not part of the murder charges in Cowart's judgment. The fantasy tape is out, too. The state is left with Nita Neary's eyewitness identification and Dr. Richard Suveron. The rest will be principally circumstantial. There are rumbles in the press section that Bundy may be back in the ballgame. Chapter 43. Judge Cowart was ready to begin the actual trial. The defense was not. On July 7th, Ted and his attorneys argued that they had not had time to prepare the opening arguments.
"We need time between your rulings and our opening statement," Peggy Good argued. "We're exhausted. We've had only 5 hours sleep a night. You're turning this into a trial by endurance." "You have 4 lawyers in Miami, 1 investigator, 2 law students helping you. As far as the court is concerned, I care about the entire system. I'm very satisfied that there is no reason to delay any further. In this circuit, it's not unusual to proceed until midnight. We vary the tune, but we've got the same fiddler, the same music. Every minute you've been here, I've been here, and I'm fresh as a daisy."
Ted tried another tack.
"I'm concerned about your honor, how you're going to do this by 1 o'clock. "You just watch us. I appreciate your concern."
And then Ted was angry. It was Saturday noon, and he wanted to start Monday. Cowart did not.
"My attorneys are not ready."
"We will begin, Mr. Bundy."
"Then you'll start without me, Your Honor,"
Ted flared. "As you like," Cowart said imperturbably, while Ted muttered,
"I don't care who he is."
But Ted was sitting at the defense table as the jury was brought in for the first time. Larry Simpson made the opening statements for the prosecution, only after reporters had sent the youthful state attorney back out to comb his hair and re-enter for the benefit of the cameras. He did a good job, diagramming the 4 Chi Omega cases, the Dunwoody Street case on a blackboard, listing the victims' names, the charges, burglary of the Chi Omega house, first-degree murder, Lisa Levy, first-degree murder, Margaret Bowman, attempted first-degree murder, Kathy Kleiner, attempted first-degree murder, Karen Chandler, attempted first-degree murder, burglary, Cheryl Thomas. He was workmanlike and showed little emotion, but he was clear and concise. Ted had picked Robert Haggard, the 34-year-old Miami attorney who'd been on the case only 2 weeks, to make the opening statements for the defense.
Judge Coward had urged the defense to wait until their half of the trial to make the opening remarks, as was their option, but they forged ahead. Haggard spoke for 26 minutes, rambled, and the prosecution objected 29 times, an almost unheard-of number. Coward sustained 23 of those objections. Finally, Coward threw up his hands and said to Haggard,
"That's argument, bless your heart. Come aboard."
I felt Ted himself could have done a better job of it. Ted did choose to cross-examine Officer Ray Crewe about his actions when he had gone to the Chi Omega house on the morning of the murders. I have no idea what was in the minds of the jury as Ted elicited information about the condition of the death rooms, the condition of Lisa Levy's body, but it seemed to me somewhat grotesque. If this calm, glib young attorney might have been there to see Lisa's body himself, might have done that terrible damage to her, he was completely dispassionate as he questioned the officer.
"Describe the condition of Lisa Levy's room." "Clothing strewn about, desk, books, some disarray."
"Any blood in any area in the room other than what you testified about earlier?"
"No, sir."
"Describe the condition of Margaret Bowman's body."
"She was lying face down, mouth and eyes open, nylon stocking knotted around her neck, head bloated and discolored."
Ted had been trying to show that the policeman had left his own prints in the room, that he had not proceeded carefully. Instead, he had only succeeded in impressing a horrible picture in the jury's minds. And then the young women, victims, witnesses, were a steady parade through the courtroom doors. Melanie Nelson, Nancy Doughty, Karen Chandler, Kathy Kleiner, Debbie Ciccarelli, Nancy Young, Cheryl Thomas. Dressed in bright cottons, they all had an innocence about them, a vulnerability. There were no outward signs that Karen and Kathy had ever been injured. The pins in their jaws, the concussions, the bruises had long since healed. Only when they told of what had happened to them could one picture the horror. They never glanced at Ted Bundy. Cheryl Thomas had more difficulty. She limped as she made her way to the witness chair, sat with her right ear toward the prosecutor so that she could hear him. She was still completely deaf in the other. She did not testify about the struggle she had had to regain her health, of the moments of jogging, sit-ups. When she'd first started to walk, she had fallen to one side, but she'd learned to compensate by using her other senses, sight and feeling. She'd learned to develop a sense of balance with her mind. She did not mention how she had fallen again and again when she resumed ballet classes, that she'd had to start over from scratch. She testified very softly, often smiling shyly. The defense wisely chose not to question the victims. Dr. Thomas Wood testified about the autopsies he had done on the dead victims, and then, over objections from Peggy Good, produced 11 by 14 inch color photos of the bodies, pointing out the damage to the jury. It is standard for defense attorneys to protest autopsy pictures, declaring them inflammatory and with no probate of value, and it is standard, too, that the pictures are admitted. I watched the faces of the jury as those terrible pictures were passed silently through their tiers of seats. The female jurors seemed to be managing better than the males, who paled and winced. There were several shots of Lisa Levy's buttocks, with the teeth imprints clearly visible. There was one close-up of Margaret Bowman called the hole-in-the-head picture by Judge Cowart, for want of a better term. There was a photograph of Lisa Levy's right breast, the nipple bitten through. I had neither seen nor talked to Ted privately. He did not have the freedom to hold conversations with those in the courtroom that he had expected. At each recess, he was led manacled to a small room across the corridor. When court recessed for the day, that day when the postmortem reports and the victim's pictures had been introduced into evidence, I stood outside in the hallway for a moment. Ted, carrying his usual pile of legal papers in his cuffed hands, emerged and walked within a few feet of me. He turned to me, smiled, shrugged, and disappeared. In Florida, reporters are allowed to view all the evidence that has been admitted. A group of us waited for Shirley Lewis, the court clerk, to trundle a huge cart full of physical evidence to her office, and there it was, spread out on a table. A miasma, real or imagined, seemed to rise from the clutter there, and the laughter and black humor common among the press corps was silenced.
We're not laughing now, are we?
Tony Polk of Denver said quietly. We were not. All the pantyhose masks were there, including the one Sergeant Bob Hayward had brought from Utah, strikingly similar to one another. The garrote from Margaret Bowman's neck, still bearing her dried blood, was there, and all the pictures. I had long since managed to deal with the photographs that are part of homicide cases with a degree of detachment. They no longer upset me as they once did, although I make it a point not to dwell on them. By the time I stood in Shirley Lewis's office, I had seen thousands of body pictures. I had seen pictures of Kathy Devine and Brenda Baker in Thurston County, but that was months before it was known there was a Ted. Of course, there were no bodies to photograph in the other Washington cases, and I had had no access to Colorado or Utah pictures. Now I was staring down at huge color photographs of the damage done to girls young enough to be my daughters, at pictures of damage alleged to be the handiwork of a man I thought I knew. That man, who only minutes before had smiled the same old grin at me and shrugged as if to say, I have no part of this. It hit me with a terrible, sickening wave. I ran to the ladies' room and threw up. Chapter 44. The cloyingly hot days in Miami's July took on a pattern. First, the mass exodus from the Civic Center Holiday Inn by most of the principals, barring the defendant, to the Justice Center 3 blocks away. Virtually all of the defense team, the prosecution team, the media people from out of town, Carol Ann Boone and her teenage son, the television cameramen and technicians were headquartered at the Holiday Inn. And some of the best quotes reporters elicited came in the evening when the little bar on the first floor was jammed with participants quaffing cold beers and gin and tonics. Here, the demarcation lines were not as pronounced as they were in the courtroom. The dash to the Justice Center. Get in there before Watson shuts the door. The journey was not without its dangers. It was necessary to cross 6 lanes of rush hour traffic, balancing on center islands as the commuters of Miami whooshed by, inches away. Don't walk under the viaduct. A reporter from Utah got mugged the other evening by some guy on a bicycle with a 6-inch blade. But then the motel itself was not exactly safe. Ruth Walsh, the ABC anchorwoman from Seattle, had lost her money, her jewelry, even her wedding rings, to a cat burglar who crept into her room from the balcony 6 floors up as she slept. We were a long way from the beaches where the tourists frolicked. A first cup of coffee of the day on the 9th floor in the communications center. Already the phones were busy, reporters putting copymen on hold, waiting for a daily update. Here the black humor mounted. 2 television reporters mimicked a personal interview with Mrs. Bundy, one of them playing the defendant's mother in a high falsetto.
And what was Ted like when he was a child, Mrs. Bundy?
Oh, he was a good boy, a good, normal, all-American boy.
What kind of toys did he like, Mrs. Bundy?
The usual things, guns, knives, pantyhose, just like any boy.
And did he have a job?
Oh, no, Teddy always had his credit cards.
Hoots of laughter. Waiting for the proceedings to flash onto the closed-circuit TV before them, the verse writers scribbled. Teddy came to Tallahassee, looking for a pretty lassie. Creeping, sneaking through the dark, lurking till he found his mark. Remember, dear, remember well, his bite is much worse than his bark. For some of the news people, the Bundy trial was only a story, and a great one at that. Others seemed disturbed, too conscious of the waste of lives involved, not only the victims, but the defendants. We were watching a major tragedy unfold before us, and it meant far more than headlines. Down on the 4th floor, the mood of the public was angry, vengeful. As I waited in line to pass through the metal detector, to submit to the search of my purse and papers that transpired every time I entered the courtroom, I heard 2 men talking behind me.
That Bundy, he ain't never going to get out of Florida alive. He's going to get what's coming to him.
They ought to take him out and nail his balls to the wall and leave him there till he dies, and that'd be too good for him.
I half turned to look at them. 2 nice, grandfatherly-looking men. They echoed the feeling of the Florida public. As the trial progressed, the crowds grew denser and more hostile. Could the jury feel it? Had they some suppressed anger of their own? You couldn't tell by looking at them.
Their faces, like all jury faces, were bland, listening. One or two of them regularly nodded off to sleep during the long afternoon sessions. Upstairs in the press room, reporters would spot that and yell at the television set, "Wake up! Wake up! Hey, Bernest! Wake up! Floyd, wake up!" Ted still glanced into the press section to see if I was there, still smiled faintly, but he seemed to be shrinking, his eyes a little more hollow each day, as if something inside him was drying up, leaving only an exhausted shell sitting at the defense table. Despite the long procession of young women, the parade of police officers who began to blend into one another somehow, the word was that Bundy might win. There was so much about him that was being held back from the jury. Danny McKeever, looking frazzled, gave short press interviews saying that he was worried, something a prosecutor rarely admits. The press began to lay odds that that son of a bitch may pull it off. We had missed a day in court because Maisie Edge had a virus. We would miss another when Ted himself came down with a high fever, a deep cough. On those days, with nothing else to do, we interviewed each other, and sidebar stories of faint human interest were sent to home papers, stories describing how reporters from other areas felt, a kind of inbred journalism. Ted was back then, looking paler, tired. Robert Fulford, manager of The Oak, testified about his first contact with Chris Hagen, of renting a room with a bunk bed, a table, chest of drawers, and a desk to him.
"He didn't have the rent when it come due. He said he could call his mother long distance in Wisconsin, and she'd send it down. I heard him make a call, and it seemed like he was talking to someone, but he never showed up with the rent. When I checked his room a couple of days later, he was gone."
The jury knew that Bundy had come to and left Tallahassee, but they would not know from whence and why. David Lee testified about his arrest of Bundy in Pensacola in the dark dawn.